But I can tell you what I see in practice is that brands that are scaling are often spending 15 to 20% of their revenue on advertising. We have seen and looked at a lot of brands that are spending over 40, and I think that's really hard to sustain unless you're getting really strong ROADs. And then there's a lot of brands that have done great with kind of SEO strategies and just organic outreach that have less than 10% advertising spend, and I think they're probably not spending enough.
Welcome to Centricity, the podcast dedicated to helping emerging middle market companies pursue growth and bridge the gap between sales and marketing. In today's episode, our host, Sean Doyle, meets with Isaac Porter to discuss navigating M&As for market breakthroughs for transformational growth. If this is your first time listening, we encourage you to subscribe and leave a rating and review. We'd really appreciate it. Now, let's dive in.
Welcome to Centricity, the podcast for C-suite executives who are looking for practical, implementable, repeatable insights to break through barriers that hold back your sales and marketing performance, that revenue you're pursuing. And in today's episode, we're going to be talking with Isaac Porter from the principle of website closers for that M&A point of view. So you don't want those barriers holding you back from merger acquisitions either. So we are going to talk to Isaac and provide you some insights around what he has learned in 20 years of experience, particularly around e-com, tech, internet business owners. And Isaac, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Sean. Glad to be here, man.
It's a thrill. What, Isaac, I always been interested. What's your biggest professional win?
You know, I've been fortunate to have a number of them. I'll tell you the one that comes to mind most recently and something that I always enjoy, but when we talk to prospective sell-side clients, we're usually coming in at a point when they're either considering to sell their business or they've already decided. And so we had a client recently who had decided to sell his business. We met him and he said, hey, you know, I've got an offer on the table for $7 million. And we looked at the business, we did an initial valuation for him, and it was a pretty good offer, you know. The multiple was in line with market multiples that we had seen for this type of business. It was a digital marketing agency that focused on SEO and backlink services. And so we said, hey, let us run your transaction. You know, we worked out a fee arrangement and let us create a competitive process for you. And we took the company to market. We had a huge response. We had a couple hundred people follow up and, you know, ask for information and sign NDAs. And we hosted seven calls with our best, most qualified buyers. And out of those seven calls, we got six offers and wow, we ended up closing that transaction at around $8.5 million, which was, you know, three quarters of a turn higher in the EBITDA multiple than where he had gotten the first offer. And so he was thrilled, you know, that, you know, more than well exceeded what our fee was. But that was just a great example of somebody who kind of had a reference point for valuation in mind. And then by running, you know, a well-organized, professional, coordinated process that kind of brought competitors in to bid on it, you know, obviously it made him more money, which is a great outcome. And his cash portion on that $8.5 million was higher than what the original $7 million was, what the $7 million offer was as a percentage of the deal. So he got a lot more cash, which is always important.
More money, more cash up front, lower risk. But other than that, Isaac, what do you do for him really? Come on.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, the big thing is that, you know, by getting to see those offers, he had 100% confidence that he had fully maximized the value of his business. You know, he saw six offers from really well-qualified buyers. They all had, you know, they all converged around evaluation. We had, of course, the one buyer got to the highest point. We went through four rounds of bidding on that deal to get the offer up to that level. And, you know, so when he sold the company, he knew empirically that he had maximized his outcome. He'd seen what the market would bear and he had negotiated everything we could. And so that's the kind of stuff I love. I love feeling great about it. You know, he's been now a referral source for us. And so that's kind of the most fun win that I've had in the last two or three months here. We've had many, many deals over the years, you know, some of them, frankly, a lot bigger than that, but that was just a fun, relevant example.
That's great. Well, I love that. That's a great win. Let's just keep rolling on that. So for companies that are thinking about, owners that are thinking about, you know, maybe it's time to be acquired. What's the most important area or focus of improvement within their business? Now, keep in mind, I've got a sales and marketing lens, but what's the most important area that you see that needs to be addressed before a business hits the market?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things we do, we'll come in and we do a pretty thorough analysis of the business. And it can be depending on the business model and what they're really good at. You know, we identify different things that are the focuses, but some things that are always important, the financials of the business are going to be looked at very closely through the sale process. And, you know, in some cases, you know, I'd even say kind of scrutinized by buyers. And the bigger the deal gets, the more thorough the diligence will be. And so we do a lot of work with companies because, you know, we've got companies that are, you know, mid 10 figure businesses that just don't really have great accounting, especially in this e-commerce space, because some of these businesses have scaled so rapidly that, you know, they don't have a lot of timeline behind them to really get, you know, a full accounting department or even a CFO in place. And so, you know, we've got some software that we can use. We've got, of course, outside CPA relationships that we have. We'll make sure their financials are packaged and presented in a way that a buyer is going to be able to understand them and is going to be valuable for the buyer through that process.
So accounting is definitely looking back, right? And I'm in the business of helping executives with that sales and marketing view, which should be a look forward, at least at your feet in sales, and maybe marketing is forward. How much of an impact does that really have on a buyer?
What really drives multiples is the growth rate of the business. And I think that is a forward-looking exercise, because what a buyer is interested in is, you know, they're going to pay for what the business is worth today based on what it has produced in the past. But what they're really investing in is the cash flow in the future. And so we do a lot of forecasting with our clients where we actually put together, you know, pro forma financial statements with their help and guidance. And then we look at what the growth opportunities are of every business. And that's a kind of a customized view depending on what the business is. But it could be, you know, it could be expanding into new markets. It could be expanding into new channels. We've got we deal with a lot of companies that they're on Amazon or they're on Shopify, or maybe they're on Amazon and Shopify, but they're not in retail. So kind of figuring out where the channel expansion opportunities are, and then developing at least a high level plan on how they would execute on attacking those markets or those channels, and then communicating that to buyers. And then when we find a buyer who's really good at one of those growth opportunities, that can become a good acquirer or a good partnership. More than half of our transactions, the seller is retaining equity in the business. So they're keeping usually a minority percentage of ownership, but they might keep 20 or 30% of the business. And then they're partnering with that new partner who's bringing in, you know, who's giving them some money. So they're taking cash off the table. And then the partner's usually bringing in some growth capital to help to grow the business to that next level. You know, people talk about, you know, kind of a 10X plan or, you know, whatever their return on investment objective is, but you've got to be able to identify those paths for growth in order to really get a buyer excited about the investment.
Interesting. Yeah, my mind's going about five different ways. You just taught me at least three things and brought up two new questions, but I don't think I can organize my thoughts that quickly. So I'm hearing a lot about transformation. You know, it's a business that's looking, and it's at a time of transformation, and maybe the current owners don't want to leave. You know, most of the stories I hear are thinking about exits. You know, people are done, they're tired, they've done what they can do, et cetera. But this transformational growth, which is interesting to me because as we work with middle market, emerging middle market businesses, a lot of them are looking for that transformational growth. What are the signals that somebody should look for to know that it's time to maybe do a partial exit?
Man, that is a great question. It's something that we talk about a lot because what I see in practice is the flip side of that question, the signal that I can definitively tell you waited too long to sell the business. And so
that's a bad signal.
That's a bad signal, but that happens a lot, especially in businesses with really high growth rates, because what drives the multiple is the growth rate, because that improves the return for a buyer. So if you expect that growth rate to stay, you know, 50% year over year growth in perpetuity, right? That's you can pay a higher multiple on those cash flows because they're going to scale as you buy it. As an owner of the business, if you're in a really high growth rate stage, your multiple would be high. But even if you make more money, but your growth rate is lower, you could end up getting a lower total valuation because your multiple, you know, if the business is flat for a year. And we've in fact seen this between 21, 22, and 23. You know, we had a lot of e-commerce and technology businesses in 21 had great years. 22, you know, there were pretty significant changes in privacy laws, in particular around businesses that were advertising on Facebook with the iOS 15 update. And even though the market demand didn't change, you know, there's some kind of external impact to their ability to track and attribute sales through Facebook. And so we saw there was a lot of industry change around that. And, you know, Facebook certainly seen that in their revenue mm-hmm. now too, Meta and in the stock price. And now we're seeing those businesses now rebound. And so the companies that put a lot of businesses out of business, candidly, but the businesses that were able to kind of get through that now have come out stronger and they're starting to grow again. And so when you're in a growth stage, your valuation will be the highest. And generally what I find is when people are the least interested in selling their business, it's probably when it's the most valuable. And because, you know, what'll happen is the business will hit a decline and it'll start to become less profitable. And an owner gets scared about their ability to grow the business or get it back to what it used to be. And so they say, I'm going to sell the business. Well, that's just inherently starting from a position of weakness, right? Once the business is declining and there's a negative sales trend, then the expectation for a buyer is going to be that it's going to continue to decline, or they have to be really confident about their ability to turn that business around. So, you know, the inverse of what I said is also true. When your growth rate is high, your multiple is high. When your growth rate is negative, your multiple gets hammered. I mean, the valuation of the business, it's shocking sometimes how the perception of the business can change just because one or two bad months. Now, what we do, you know, our job as intermediaries and brokers and advisors is to understand what's drove that change, what's driving the performance, and then determine if it's something that can be fixed. If the performance is bad, you know, can it be fixed, and what's the path to do that? And can we find a buyer who has that skill set? And then we have to be able to explain that to the buyer. So, you know, we've sold lots and lots of companies with declining revenue. I'm not saying you can't do it, but it definitely is probably the biggest impact on declining valuation.
As data compliance laws become more stringent, many organizations will soon have non-compliant CRM data. Maybe you have insufficient first-party data, or you bought information from an improperly validated third party. However, you got it. Fixing it before the 2023 deadline should be a top priority. Fitzmartin's Wake the Dead program takes dead CRM prospects and applies a behavioral science model to re-engage them into your pipeline. In this process, you can reclaim old prospects or delete old ones, giving you a clean and compliant database with new opportunities from previously forgotten contacts. By retargeting with email and text automation, clients you might have considered dead or unresponsive will move forward and become potential prospects once again. For more information, check out the show notes or visit fitzmartin.com.
Isaac, I'd be interested in your opinion. We will talk about power in marketing as and positioning really as the singular proposition upon which sales and marketing should stand. And you mentioned power. When you have that decline, you lose power as a seller. Well, the same thing happens in any sales and marketing relationship. The power of a well-positioned company, meaning there's a reason to buy from them. There's something unique about them. They stand out from the crowd. Is there a specific aspect of going through an M&A experience where you evaluate that kind of thing? Like, here's their positioning, here's their competitor's positioning, and this is why. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So, you know, there's 26 different factors we look at when we're getting ready to list a business. And one of them is always going to be, you know, what competitive moats does the business have around it? Is there any intellectual property associated with the business that differentiates it from its competitors? And so, you know, we see a lot of businesses that have, you know, design patents in place, they've got good trademarks in place, and they've got a product that is, you know, unique in the market or hard to copy because they've got these protections. And so that drives value, that creates power, that creates leverage for the seller. The business model itself can be a source of leverage and power. So stability of cash flow. Really, what buyers really care about fundamentally is the stability and predictability of cash flow. So businesses that have higher recurring revenues, higher lifetime value for their customers, those businesses get a better multiple and thereby, to answer your question, you know, have more negotiating power for the sale process. So, you know, subscription-based revenue is very valuable because you can make really strong predictions about how long people stay subscribers on average, how fast the subscriber base is growing. Typically, you know, especially in the software space, we represent a lot of SaaS companies. The software usually has a high upfront development cost and then really high profit margins. The further you go out, you're just kind of maintaining right. and updating that software. And so those are really attractive businesses to a lot of buyers because high margin, high predictability, recurring cash flows with high LTV. And what you can do with that is you can then afford to spend more money on acquiring customers because you know you're going to keep them longer and monetize them over a period of time. And so, you know, the advertising opportunities on those businesses with high LTVs become interesting because you can, and there's a lot of different strategies yeah. on what the optimal customer acquisition cost should be, but it's always going to be correlated to the LTV.
Interesting. When you are working with these companies, how often do you see a dashboard, company's leadership team dashboard where sales is represented? I'll answer that 100% of the time. How often do you see where marketing is represented on the dashboard in a weekly review?
Marketing in terms of a department or in terms of spend? I think what I...
Department.
What I see... Yeah, not as much, right? I think what I see that, you know, our founders in the e-commerce and technology space track quite closely is their spend on advertising and the percentage of spend, you know, the percentage of ad spend as a percentage of revenue. The ad spend as a percentage of
right.
revenue.
Do you have any rules of thumb on what those ad spends should be? We use some data that I think is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'd be interested in your feedback. I tell you what I see in practice is that brands that are scaling are often spending 15 to 20% of their revenue on advertising. We have seen and looked at a lot of brands that are spending over 40, and I think that's really hard to sustain unless you're getting, you know, really strong ROAS. And then, you know, there's a lot of brands that have done great with kind of SEO strategies and just organic outreach that have less than 10% advertising spend. And I think they're probably not spending enough. You know, those are opportunities, I think, to scale those business with paid, but yeah.
So again, we're focusing that B2B emerging middle market space. And so we're using data from Gartner, from Deloitte, and from Wall Street Journal. So people know Deloitte and Wall Street Journal. Gartner is a data source. It's an organization that focuses on chief marketing officers globally. And the numbers that we see are really vastly ranging. So the catch 22 of, hey, what's the rule of thumb, Isaac, is there is none, right? There are people that perform. We have people that are performing incredibly well, radical EBITDA growth year after year on 3%. And we have one that's performing under. The data from the three organizations I mentioned ranges from 6% up to 18%. So B2B products are probably in that 15%. B2B services are a little bit higher. They're more than that 18%. But all B2B and as a whole, I would encourage people to at least think about 8% and then find some data to see how they're comparing to competitors. Typically, however, if I was, Isaac, if you were asking me to help you in your business market, as soon as I said those numbers in your head, you just did the math and went, I'm not spending anywhere near that. That's crazy. You marketing schmuck, get out of my face. So it's, you know, you have to scale up and prove it.
Right? You scale up and you need to have, because at some point, right, if you can attribute profitability to that spend, then I would say you scale infinitely, mm-hmm. right? As long as you're keeping right. it in percentage in terms of a reasonable yeah. percentage of your total.
And I love that you just said yeah. that. We're working on a dashboard right now, and the dashboard is going to look at marketing influence, not marketing attribution. So B2B, you're going to have more influence from marketing, not I closed a multi-million dollar deal with 13 decision makers. It's just not a very transactional sale. The more transactional it is, the more you could attribute to marketing with less emphasis on sales. And we're looking at how much of the total is of total revenue has had marketing touch on any of the buying organizations. So just as a percentage, we're saying, hey, of $30 million of sales, for example, marketing has some influence that we could record through tools, any number of marketing automation tools, CRM tools, MAT tool, all the different acronyms you can think of in marketing. And then we're saying, of that 30 million, marketing touched people at 80%, we're at 30% or 20%. And we're just tracking that. So how does marketing influence? I think that's kind of an interesting model. That's why I asked you the dashboard question. It's one that we're considering making a standard recommendation of. Because, sales typically is going to react with, well, marketing didn't close the deal. And Fitzmartin's belief is to say, yes, you're right. Marketing did not close the deal. But we had some influence because these eight decision makers came to touch these aspects of marketing communication. So it should be aligned. Those two departments should be aligned. All right. Closing questions. This has been good. Tell me, what's the most transformative thing you've seen or learned about the businesses you're helping, about the way they're approaching sales and marketing? What's been?
Oh man, that's a great question right now, Sean. Hands down, it's the explosion in artificial intelligence technologies that's going on right now. There are, and I am every day finding new tech out there that I'm fascinated by it personally and professionally, because I'm convinced that the early adopters of the right technologies are going to outperform their peers that are not using some of these technologies. So we're seeing, artificial technology that is changing bids for paid traffic every second. You can put that into technology. Yep. You can automate social media posts. I just interviewed a company called Black Crow a week ago on my podcast, the Deal Closers podcast, that their software can, within under a second, when a new customer goes onto an e-commerce site, like a Shopify site, they can predict with 80% accuracy if that customer will purchase and how much they'll spend. So think about that. Somebody clicks on your page in under a second, 80% with an 80% likelihood that they're going to purchase and how much money they're going to spend. And then you can push them in real time. You can push them out advertisements and offers based on that prediction. Yeah. So you can bifurcate them. Huge stuff going on in artificial intelligence technology in the e-commerce space right now. And, we're in my brokerage firm, we're using GPT-4 right now for automating content and blog posts. And there's just so much that's going to come out of it. And, I think a lot of people are scared of it. I don't know where AI goes long term, but for right now, I'm really interested in what it's going to do in the e-commerce and tech space over the next year.
I love that. And we are 100% aligned with you. In fact, on the other side of the wall is a guy whose job it is at my company is to write prompts. And if you don't know what I just said, then got to dive in. So it's to write instructions. Yeah. And there's the idea that, and I think the fear that I sense and see comes from, it's just a tool that scrapes the internet and it generates content. And yeah, that's true. But Isaac, you just got done saying a business that adds value, that has business intelligence, that has IP is worth more than one that doesn't, right? If I just go out and resell something, I've got very low value as a business. One of our goals as a company, as we've always had trademarked intellectual property, and we call it centricity. It's an approach to a buyer's journey, and there's 10 best practices based on behavioral science, how to get people through that pipeline in the fastest way possible, in the most effective way possible, and to do exactly what you're talking about, Isaac. So we're now with AI, what we're leaning into is when you work with Fitzmartin, your prompts are going to be part of what you get. That's what you're buying from us. We're going to equip your teams with the prompts. We're going to be able to do consulting work and look at deal closers and help y'all, websiteclosers.com, and tell you, here's the three things that you should be able to do. In the past, I had to have a college-educated MBA type to manually go through. Well, I know the prompts, the business intelligence, and that's what we're codifying into an IP that's protected. And now we'll start selling it. And at some point, we'll sell it and license it to other agencies, and we'll sell it and license it to businesses that want to buy it. And it's all about the prompts. Exciting.
Prompts are so cool. I'm like, I can geek. Sean, we should get back on and we can geek out over prompts if you want to share some. I spend hours talking about prompts and, because you know this, right? Is you tweak what you're asking the technology to do just a little bit, and your outcome is like way better. I started and I would ask, I would say, write me a social media post. Okay, fine. And then I say, you know, now I've got a prompt that's like 8 sentences long that is super specific, and the output that I get is phenomenal. You know, it's good enough in most cases to go right up on my Twitter. So,
well, and you know, people that think it's just about it's lazy people's way to generate content, those people will not be rewarded. Just like bad writers are not rewarded. Bad writing that has no value isn't rewarded. So if you write a fast prompt that all it does is scrape the internet, then who cares? Then it was already out there. But if you write these prompts, then you're adding business value. I think most people don't get that. We're doing a talk to a CMO Institute in about 3 weeks. So man, I'm pumped up on this right now too. And here's another, I just want to share this too. We're going to play Stump the Chump with Isaac Porter live on Centricity.
Does that make me the chump, John?
I think I did just say that. And now it's going to be really risky to answer this. When did it get going? Everybody thinks it started last week.
When did AI get going?
Yeah.
Oh man, I have no idea.
I'm going to say
Google's been working on Bard for years. Yeah.
Yeah. In 2017 was the first kind of noted musical album creation that was totally algorithmically driven. I mean, that's a long time ago, right? And then people are using AI all the time. Watson, I think, it was an incredibly effective marketing use of AI. And Watson does a little bit of what you were talking about, Isaac, where Isaac Porter, who's a physician and a surgeon, and you know, Watson, IBM was delivering ads to different people, and that ads were created with AI based on all the data we could pull in from Isaac. And every ad was customized. I mean, that's incredible tools. So because in my career, 20 years ago, we took a guess at creating a TV spot that might reach Isaac. And we'd put it on the masters and hope that he'd buy some technology. Well, now we've got all this data about who, and it's custom content. It's incredible. Okay, I'm rambling on. We are getting off.
It's so fascinating right now. And I'll give you, Sean, I'll give you my app pick of the day since we're talking about this. It's called Nova, N-O-V-A. I'm not affiliated with Nova, and nor do I have any affiliate link with Nova. I just think it's a cool app. It's ChatGPT-4 on your iPhone. And you can cut and paste right from the chat prompt. It's super cool. And I'm on a free trial right now. So I'm all about it.
Interesting. Do you have to have a subscription?
But I'll subscribe to this. Yeah. No,
My GPT account?
I don't know that. That's a great question. I don't know that. I just literally started playing with it. But I think it's cool.
I feel like, disclaimer, this is not an AI tech how-to show. All right. Elevate back up. Yeah. Elevate. Yeah. But the value of it is incredible. And we've got to go. So my question is, what's the most transformative thing? And amen. Well, I do want to wrap up. But before we do, I got to end it. We started with your biggest professional win. You're like a nutcase triathlete, right? What's been your favorite city, location, biggest triathlon win?
Well, you know, for a win in a triathlon is a finish.
Amen.
For most of us. So, you know, there's a lot of great races. I think I've done 30 triathlons. I'm a North Carolina guy. So yeah, my favorite one is a half Ironman in Wilmington, North Carolina called Ship to Shore. So you swim by a big battleship and it's a pretty cool triathlon.
All right. Anybody who doesn't know what he just said, Isaac's a stud is what he just said. Cause that's serious. I did like a sprint one time 20 years ago and I thought I was a hero. And a sprint is like sipping a teacup compared to the big mug of what you're doing, Isaac. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's anything else. You know, you set a focus and you train for it and you build up and, you know, you do it step by step. It's like a lot of things we do in our businesses.
Sounds very process oriented. Love it. Thank you for joining us this week on Centricity. I know I've learned a great deal and I'll be following your work as we continue to go. For your listeners who are interested in what you do, how can they keep up with you?
Yeah, you know, I'm really on all social channels. Ecom Porter, ECOMMPORTER. You can find me on LinkedIn at Isaac Porter, IZACHPORTER.
Excellent. And you just did a podcast with one of my coworkers on Ecom, Will Riley. Where's that podcast?
Yep, that is the Deal Closers podcast. My company is websiteclosers.com. So yeah, we've got Deal Closers podcast. We talk about new tech that can help you get ready to sell your e-com and technology business. And we talk a lot with founders of companies who we've sold and kind of talk through their story of how they started their business and ultimately came to the decision to sell it.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, we're going to sign off until we see you again next time, listeners. Talk soon.
We sure appreciate you listening today. If you would like to get in contact with today's guest or stay in touch with us, visit our show notes. Additionally, to get the latest strategies for the alignment between marketing and sales, visit fitzmartin.com. As a reminder, if you have found value in today's episode, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify, or your favorite podcast directory. Until next time, thanks for listening.